Ladies and gentlemen, let's get going. I'm Paul Yock. I'm glad to welcome you on behalf of the program in Biodesign. Thank you for tolerating the parking situation. I know it's terrible, and we'll have more people coming in the next few minutes. So if you can make room for them as they clamber over your knees, that would be great. A couple of announcements. If you could please turn off your cell phones or turn them to vibrate, because we'll be making an audio recording of the program. I also want to let you know that there'll be a reception right after the session here, and that'll be out over here where you came in. Chance to say hi to Fred and the other characters that are here in the audience. We'll run for about an hour. There'll be questions at the end, and I think instead of trying to use the mic, if you can just holler out your questions, and David will repeat them for the sake of the audio recording. One other thing, and that is to say thanks to Wilson Sonsini and Price Waterhouse, who are sponsors of this evening's event, and then also to Wendover Elsevier, who are loaning us David for the interview, and David Kasich will introduce our speaker for tonight.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Paul. So I'm looking out at this audience, and I see Will Sampson and here, and Hanson. I mean, how appropriate that we have just a stellar group of device engineers to come and listen to Fred Khosravi, because really that's where this story begins. But really, I had to say Fred has an amazing sense of humor as well. And I was saying to somebody that if the interview goes, the stage interview goes half as well as the preparation interview we do before this, this will be a very enjoyable evening. Just one kind of sample of Fred's wit. When he found out there was a reception, he wanted to know why the alcohol was served after the interview before. So, which I said actually makes me think that in fact we should start serving it.
But wouldn't it before, be more fun?
I think it would make it more coherent for the rest of the evening. So Fred is actually one of those guys, not rare in this industry, but who didn't begin in medical devices, or at least that was not his initial inclination. Before we actually get into the medical device career, you're from Iran, you're Kurdish.
Yes.
Talk about how you got here, what sent you to the United States, and give us two words on your father.
I'd be happy to. First of all, I mean, this is like coming to a combination fraternity sorority, basically, that I've lived in for the last 10, 15 years, basically. So it's great to see everybody here. It's really a great honor, and I'm really not trying to be humble here. I was telling Paul in his office that I really don't feel like I've earned this. Not that you guys will get your money back or anything like that. But my nose has been really too close to the grindstone. So this is a great honor. I appreciate it, Paul, and looking forward to the conversations. But my background, I'm Kurdish, from Iran. Both mother and father Kurdish. My dad was in the Kurdish liberation movement. Today he would be called a terrorist. And he fought pretty much most of his life to essentially maintain and uphold the Kurdish identity, which is an identity that if you don't really try to hold on to it, it's going to go away, basically. So he fought long and hard, spent 10 years in Shah's jails, and then came out and actually got back on his feet. So he was a real testament to entrepreneurship.
Well, and also he was a member of a cabinet, which most of the other ministers were executed, but his sentence was commuted.
Yes.
So how did you get to the United States? And I know you started in Tennessee. Why did you start in Tennessee, of all places? I know there's a natural Kurd-Tennessee
Kurdish attraction,
there.
Yeah, to Cookeville, Tennessee. In fact, I'm wearing my Tennessee Tech cufflinks to to Stanford. I figured it would be, those guys would like to hear that. So Tennessee, because I was effectively running away from the revolution. I wasn't running away from the revolution. I actually wanted to be part of the revolution. My dad didn't think that was a great idea. So he put me on a plane and sent me out here. And I was 16 years old. and started basically in Cookeville, Tennessee, because a friend of mine who had actually come to the U.S. about a year before, he ended up in Cookeville, Tennessee. And so that's where I came.
So your background and your training went as an education, and you told me that as you were graduating, you're looking at several industries, devices, automotive, and defense. Why did you choose devices, and where was your first job?
So that actually probably has a lot of luck associated with it. So I had an offer out of school from automotive industry, from the defense industry, and from medical devices. And I really didn't even know what medical devices was. But it sounded a little bit more exciting than the defense industry and automotives. So I actually walked into that not knowing really what I'm getting myself into. So there was a good sense of naivete in that, basically.
Mm-hmm. So your first job was at Silco, where I guess you moved from the big city of Cookeville, Tennessee, to the bigger city of Huntington, West Virginia. Tell us about Silco.
It was a big improvement.
For
from 40,000 people to 120,000 people. It was fine. I enjoyed it. I was.
What'd you do for Silco? Silco was an IOL company?
Intraocular lens company, yeah. And I actually went in as a lens designer to design some of those early intraocular lenses, basically, the small incision ones. And then I actually got on the manufacturing floor, which some of the people who work closely with me and are in from the manufacturing discipline are probably cringing to hear that. But I got on the manufacturing floor, and I actually automated the machining process for intraocular lenses through lathes and mills, and I became a hero, instant hero, and all that kind of stuff. So it was really nice. It was a great experience.
So Silco was acquired by CooperVision, and you moved to Seattle. What were you doing for CooperVision at that point?
So I was got promoted to engineering manager there for small incision lenses, foldable lenses, basically, which were transitioning. They were transitioning from hard lenses to foldable silicone lenses, basically.
And then Cooper was acquired by Alcon. Why did you not stay with that? Why did you not stay with Cooper Alcon at that point? What made you want to leave?
That's another kind of turn of events, which is somewhat accidental, because I was one of the six people out of a plant of about 300-400 people who was offered to actually go down to Fort Worth and join the Alcon operation, basically. And I went down there with my wife to Fort Worth, and my wife kind of looked around and said, there's no way in hell I'm ever going to live in this place.
After Huntington, West Virginia, Cookeville, Tennessee, she said no to Fort Worth.
Yeah, so we had I had an offer from ACS, and we came to San Francisco, and it looked like a pretty cool place, so we actually took this one.
What were you going to do for ACS? Because you were not a cardiovascular device specialist.
I had more of an implantable product discipline, basically, and ACS was looking for few guys who had implantable product discipline, because it was a fully disposable product company, balloons, wires, sheets, basically. So I was hired out of that industry to work on stents.
That's interesting, because ACS's founder, John Simpson, was famous for not thinking that stents were going to be the success that they were. What did you do on that project, and how did it progress within ACS, and talk about the stent program
tough.
In ACS early days.
It was quite tough. Will Sampson, who's here, who's somebody who I worked for at ACS and I learned a lot from, is probably, you recall, Will, that it was an uphill battle. I mean, nobody believed in it. It was, we were working under a circumstance that most folks believe that stenting is going to be, at best, a solution to abrupt closure, or at worst, a bridge to surgery product, basically. Mm-hmm. But angioplasty and disposable products are going to be continue to be the mainstay of this industry.
Where were the original designs for stents? And I mean, were you aware of what, say, Julio Palmas was doing down on his stuff? I mean, that was been even prior to Johnson & Johnson's acquisition of the It
was.
License of the,
yeah,
of
I think the contribution that Julio made to the field is obviously pretty foundational, if mm-hmm. you will. I mean, we were looking at his stance, we were trying to understand it, we were trying to understand what it does well, what it does not do well, and try to come up with new solutions.
But I know Julio shopped his stent design to a lot of different companies. In fact, it's kind of one of the ironies that he wound up licensing it to Ethicon, of all companies. Why did ACS not take a chance on the Palmol shot stent if they were interested in developing a stent?
That's a question you have to ask Bill, because that must have been before me.
Okay. So how long did you stay at ACS?
So I was at ACS for about 3.5 years and really, really enjoyed my time there and became a big disciple of the ACS culture and the ACS growth and empowerment and what have you. I mean, it was a phenomenal place to work. I think there should definitely be a huge case study written about ACS and mm-hmm. what it has done in terms of spawning off so many entrepreneurs. And it wasn't just balloons and wires and stents. It's everything else that actually got spawned off of ACS afterwards that you really have to kind of look back and say, wow, it does help to have an institutional view about growth of technology, about being organic, about being entrepreneurial, so to speak.
So while you were there, the Multilink, which was Guidance first, ACS Guidance first big step, talk about the development of Multilink. And I know that Guidance, from once it launched Multilink, embarked on a series of, this was after you left, of course, rapid product iteration, developing and launching a new stent every year. Was that part of the original design, or was that a later strategy that was developed in the stent program?
So I was just actually telling Paul that, again, this is not trying to be cheesy, but I actually don't find myself as the sharpest knife in the drawer. I'm not stupid, but...
we'll be the judge of that.
But you know what? It's been hanging out with one great group of people at every part of my career, basically. So I got into ACS, and there was an amazing team in place. I mean, Lilip Lau, who I was working with Ulrich Sigvart on the one hand, who was really the father of stenting, and a guy who was foolishly optimistic that one day every human being should have a stent in them, basically, a guy who was coming out of Case Western, young guy, fresh out of college, who was just amazingly bright, and I became part of that team, mm-hmm. and actually had the privilege of running it, and out of it actually came out the Multilink stent. So it was a phenomenal team in place that made that happen.
Do you have a sense of when the entrepreneurial bug first bit you in? When we were talking, you used the phrase entrepreneurial naivete. What do you mean by that?
I mean not knowing what's not possible. I mean, it's like if you know how much it hurts, you really don't go after it. So mm-hmm. I think guys that are very, very smart, you can't be too smart to be an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm. So you actually proposed to Lilip that they spin off the stent business into a separate company. Whatever happened to that idea?
So we actually created Endotex out of the spinoff out of Guidance?
Yeah. Is that where Endotex came from?
Where Endotex came from. So Endotex was really the brainchild of Ulrich Sigvart's, a coiled sheet stent technology, as Multilink was, but the Endotex stent was his actual brainchild with his name on the patents. We were not able to actually develop it within ACS, and we decided to stop the project in favor of Multilinks. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in 1995, after I had actually left ACS and joined a company called Focal in Boston and Cambridge, recruited by Mark Levin, who used to be at Mayfield Funds, and then he decided to actually go out there and begin his hands on being an entrepreneur, basically. So Mark recruited me out of there. I stayed with Focal for a couple of years or so, learned a tremendous amount from Mark. Mark went on and started Millennium Pharmaceuticals right. after Focal. And came back, actually didn't come back, but one evening I was at my home, had one of those rinky-dink fax machines, basically, and my fax machine started, and out came a quick fax from Ulrich Sigvart with an attachment, basically, to it. And the fax cover was from Sigvart saying, hey, Endotex is about to cede their rights to this technology. You and I have been talking about doing something together all the time. Do you want to talk about it? So I was on the first plane, literally, almost within about 2 days, back to the Bay Area, and I had a meeting with Ginger Howard, Ginger Graham. She was Howard back then. Mm-hmm. And we started actually talking about her letter to Ulrich Sigvart, and I just wanted to scope out when they said they wanted to cede their rights, what did that mean, basically? Mm-hmm. Eventually, it meant that they wanted 50% of the company for it. which was not going to be sustainable. So we eventually kind of wrangled ourselves into a 15% position for guidance. But it was, we both got to know each other really well.
So before we go into text, because I think that was, as far as I think we're here, in terms of your startup, that was such an important story for you. Talk a little more about Focal. What did it do and what did you learn at Focal? You told me you learned a lot about starting a company and getting a company off the ground at Focal. What did Focal do for those who don't know, and what did you learn there?
Yeah, so I think Mark Levin was really became a great mentor. He was he's working hard and connecting with his team. He believed in what he was doing. He was it didn't seem like it was just a financial exercise. It was more of a holistic experience of you got to cultivate people, cultivate an opportunity, and if you do all of that stuff, then the right thing is going to be in place. And I learned a lot from him. He really became one of my very early mentors after Ulrich in this process. Mm-hmm. And so he would be the first guy who would come into the office, the last one to walk out, and even if he weren't in the office, he was working on the phone with Japan trying to raise money, and he just worked harder than everybody else.
So as you said, about the middle of 1995, Ulrich Sigvart came back to you with an idea. Talk a little bit about what Endotex's technology was and your experience there, because you it was actually not a particularly happy experience for you.
Yeah, so Endotex, we started the company, began developing Ulrich's technology, and started, it was during the era where, again, we had, just like these past few months, or these past couple of years, I should say, an environment where a lot of money was flowing into deals, basically. There was this kind of a spirit of money coming in through the back door, going out the front door. And so companies were springing up, companies were going public, and companies were getting acquired, and so on and so forth. So we got a little confounded by that, and we began doing too many things at the same time, not necessarily focusing on those fundamental things that you have to do with the business, basically, being cost efficient, being focused, and so on and so forth to be successful.
Can you elaborate on that? Because, I mean, I think some people would think the notion of having too much money and working on too many projects, given that things go wrong, would be a luxury, be a nice thing to have. But you do hear from a lot of entrepreneurs that having too much money is sometimes as much a curse as it is a good thing. What do you mean when you said you had too much money flowing in?
It is, and I'm glad we actually didn't drink before, so nobody could throw a glass at me or anything like that for saying what I'm about to say. But I think money is like any other good thing, right? It's like sugar. Too much of it will give you diabetes. I mean, it's great. You can take on as much as you want, and you can also take on as much as you can now because you may never get it again and all that kind of stuff. But if you're always in this routine of taking on too much of it, there is definitely diabetes, which we're actually seeing right now in the marketplace as a result of it.
So this is your first venture as the CEO of a company, and you told me that you literally destroyed it and then had to face putting the company back together again. How did you fix the company? And for you personally, what was that like? I mean, what was the experience of realizing that you had messed up? And here's John Maroney's walking in.
Hey, John.
In the back room.
Actually,
so,
at exactly
so
the right
exactly
time.
This is exactly the right time, too.
So I was probably, I would say, there was a seed of kind of recognition that I had to get out of the way and give way to somebody who could actually put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And it was actually John Maroney who did that. And I learned a lot in that process.
Who was urging you to do that? Was that a difficult decision? Was it a decision you came to? Was it a decision your investors came to? And how was it hard for you to accept?
No, actually, fortunately for me, it was an easy decision to make. John and I immediately kind of saw eye to eye on what we wanted to do, basically. And I knew wholeheartedly that I had to step out of the way because I had made some catastrophic mistakes.
Such as
being all over the place, doing too many things, but mostly confounded by, I'd say, a notion that Endotex ended up being about me as opposed to being about the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I think that the biggest lesson from that catastrophe for me was that you have to subordinate yourself to the process. Mm-hmm. That it's not about what my investors will think of me after that, what my team will think of me after that, what do other people think of me, what my family will think of me after that. Because I think those things all end up becoming very confounding phenomenons, basically, that it'll factor into your decision.
Did you leave Endotex, or did you have a continuing role there?
I had a continuing role. We had a consultant for about a year.
Mm-hmm. It was while you were at Endotex that you joined a former Focal employee and started INCEPT. Talk about INCEPT and what it was designed to do.
Yeah, so a year before I left Endotex, while I was actually doing my consulting, my current partner, Amar Sahani, and I, who actually started at Focal together, so Focal, the experience was that I was on a pretty, the way I was looking at it, rapid ascent within ACS guide, and I had become the business unit manager for Stance, enjoying what I was doing, and I was really happy. I had three programs, biodegradable stents, regular metallic stents, and a temporary stent under me. So it was like you were in a one of the most exciting sandboxes you could ever be in. And then I got recruited by Mark Levin. I went to Boston, to Cambridge, and he walked me into the office. There was like basically a room and four desks. And so I said, so what's going on here? He goes, here it is. I said, here's what? He goes, here's the company. So it was him sitting at one desk, Amar Sahani, who was a fresh PhD graduate out of University of Texas, smart guy, very visible because he wears a turban and colorful ones. And myself sitting there, and there was one desk that was actually empty. And so that was the company. And so Amar and I ended up getting to know each other really well and becoming good friends. And so several years later, after Focal and Endotex, when Amar was beginning to develop the guts to want to be an entrepreneur on his own, he came out and he said, let's do something together. Mm-hmm. And I was actually beginning to transition out of Endotex at the time. So we sat down, and there were a couple of things that we talked about. And this is by no means, even though it's going to sound like that, it's not a revisionist history, basically. But we said, let's be a little bit more thoughtful about starting companies than just kind of starting another one, because we just made a bunch of pretty horrible mistakes, and see whether we can actually do it better next time. We basically started talking about the fact that we need to create a little bit of a hedging strategy, a group of people who are willing to actually do stuff together and do a number of things together so that you don't necessarily live and die. I mean, you sit around the table at a boardroom. Everybody has a hedging strategy. The VCs have a hedging strategy. The physicians and the independents who are sitting on the board, they have a hedging strategy. But the entrepreneur is the only component of that equation that lives and dies by the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And you've got that black cloud. If it becomes a failure, you've got that black cloud that travels with you for the rest of your life until such time you create a successful one, right? And so the question was, how do you really set up something where entrepreneurs, there would be a group of entrepreneurs who would actually have a hedging strategy? And so we decided to actually take our technologies and kind of put them together. He had some things, and I had some things basically with Amr Salahia as we were developing a technology for distal protection while I was transitioning out of Endotex.
Did you have any qualms after the Endotex experience about starting or running your own companies? Did the prospect that you could repeat Endotex make you nervous about launching? Because the first company out of INSEP was EPI, the embolic protection company.
Yeah. Well, the first day I started actually thinking about doing something else, I realized that I had zero confidence in myself mm-hmm. after Endotex. I mean, it was quite catastrophic. So John knows we had actually started working on a technology, and because we were so focused, again, because it wasn't about the business, it was about me, because we were so focused on answering those kind of questions instead of the business questions, we had forgotten about asking some fundamental questions about the opportunity, about the technology, and what have you. And one day, John and I realized, when John had actually put his own money into the company and had come in to run it, that what we had on the table that we were actually focusing on was just an absolute failure. It was never going to make it. And so the overwhelming pain of going home and kind of having my head between my legs and saying, I mean, can't be more catastrophic than that, 4 years later, basically, or three, 4 years later, it was a great learning experience. Mm-hmm. So, but there was this filter thing going on with Nick Hopkins, who really has become one of my big mentors in life. He started working with us and collaborating with us in this process with myself and Amr Salahia. And I went to Rob Kooling, who I see in the audience also, who became one of my other mentors in the process. And we sat down, and it was really more of a social visit, basically, because Rob has always been very kind. And I was sitting there, so Rob said, so Fred, what are you going to do now? And I had my head down, really, quite sheepishly. I said, you know what, I'm looking at this technology, but I was hemming and hawing. I really didn't have the confidence to spill it out, so to speak. And Rob goes, well, we'd love to take a look at it. I said, are you kidding me, Rob? I just screwed up your company completely. And Rob said, which really became an important inflection point in my career, Rob said, Fred, it's not about what happens. It's about what you do when it actually happens. When you have failure coming in your direction, it's about how you respond to it, and us as VCs kind of look at that and effectively look at entrepreneurs to see how they actually react to failure. What you did, I would definitely, I don't even need to look at the technology. We'll put $500,000 in whatever you do in the process. And so that really became the confidence booster. I mean, it was almost like being here right now, sitting down and talking to you guys. And being and the honor of that, it led me to go out there and try to really take the mistakes and what I had learned, which when you're making a catastrophic mistake in a place, there's no way you could actually go clean up that catastrophic mistake. I mean, you're so now shaped by people's viewpoints of your catastrophic mistakes that you can't really fix it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to almost go to a new place to try to rebuild it, and that's what I did at EPI.
So before I get to the advisor, I mean, just one clarification. You couldn't have screwed up Endotex too bad. I mean, John maybe deserves a lot of, but Endotex actually wound up having a successful exit with Boston Scientific.
Well, John put the Humpty Dumpty back together. He deserves full credit for it. I stayed there and helped recognizing the abject failure that the technology that we were developing was, stayed there to help modify it and get it in a direction that we can actually still build value in it.
So talk a little bit about EPI. And I think the interesting thing about EPI is, if I just phrase it this way, here you just came off a abject failure in a technology that was well adopted. You did have some technology from the idea was suggested by a pretty eminent interventional cardiologist, but embolic protection was not a well-accepted technology at the time. In fact, in the early days of embolic protection, if you said to an interventional cardiologist that you've got you need a filter or a balloon to catch these emboli, most of them would have told you you're crazy. We don't need to do that. Talk about EPI in the early days and how you got into embolic protection.
Yeah, so it was actually a crazy thing to get into and a crazy time to get into it, basically, because we were effectively going to become the fourth or fifth player into a technological development timeline that had gone like 3-4 years before us, basically. But I think it was all the people that actually came together. It was first and foremost Nick Hopkins, who became one of our co-founders and one of my all-time mentors. Hank Plain, who ended up looking at the technology and naively saying, "This is damn good stuff. I want to be a part of this," and became the other mentor of mine, basically all-time mentors of mine in the process. And Mark Woolley, who was actually with me as a partner, both at Endotex and also at EPI, and we continue to work together. He's really one of the guys who I look up to very much.
Mm-hmm. So EPI was developed. Was EPI the first filter company in embolic protection?
No. So there were three different technologies before us, going back about 3-4 years before mm-hmm. us. But we ended up becoming the first filter into the U.S. market.
Mm-hmm. Was it around this time that PercuSurge achieved its tremendous success in its sale to Medtronic? What impact did PercuSurge have on the development of EPI or embolic protection, generally speaking?
I would say really not much. Not that I can, not that I can think of in terms of commercialization. I think they paved the way from a technology standpoint. They took a number of boulders off the road from a regulatory and process standpoint, and there was a lot of great engineering that actually was built into that product. But it was, at least at the time that we came into the market, it was being viewed as the wrong technology, basically, mm-hmm. for the application.
So as we noted before, Endotex was eventually sold to Boston Scientific, but actually EPI was sold to Boston even before the Endotex deal. And for as bad as your experience at Endotex was, EPI was really an incredible success for its investors. What did you learn different? How did you approach EPI differently? What had you learned from that Endotex experience that you applied to EPI? Why was EPI so much more successful than Endotex?
I would say a great, great dose of luck, which probably more than 50%. the right confluence of people who came together. I think there was clearly a belief when I was leaving Endotex that eventually the carotid stents, which Endotex was developing, has to be married with some kind of a distal protection, basically. Otherwise, carotid stenting isn't going to necessarily take shape. And so I believe John believed that, Endotex believed that, but we moved on, and there were so many sins that had been committed in terms of being defocused and not being cost efficient that it wasn't really sustainable with an Endotex to actually develop a filter. So we took it off, and basically looking at quite a bit of interesting, and again, naively, I'm going to reintroduce this word naive, basically, naivete, naive technology development. So you had Amr Saleh here, who is one of the really amazingly brilliant guys in the space, who's also given birth to another company called Sadra Medical that is going to be the next rage in percutaneous valves, basically. Amr, Jeff Krolik, who was a young guy, basically, I was actually asking him how old he was a couple of days ago. He's 37 years old, and he's on his third company. Mm-hmm. So when EPI was going on, he was 27 years old. So there was a great group of people who didn't know what was not possible. They started coming up with a technology that was out of the box. The first time we showed the filters to folks, they kind of looked at it and said, what the hell is this? I mean, filters are supposed to be baskets attached to a wire and all of that, and this thing looked like a unsupported butterfly net, basically, which made no sense whatsoever, just from a standpoint of intuitiveness for people. And then we took the first units that Amr, Jeff, and Jackson, and the team back there had developed, and I took it. I had the courage of putting them in my bag and flying to New York to Nick Hopkins, and Nick was very excited. It was really one of his first companies that was actually, he felt like it was his. He was really, he had started it. And so proudly, he took us into the animal lab, and the first device was taken off, and Nick proudly put the device into the animal, and we had these radiopaque particles that we were going to inject and actually see that fluoroscopically to see how much of the stuff would get trapped in the filter. So Nick goes ahead and injects the radiopaque particles, and the particles kind of on fluoro kind of come close to the filter and go past the filter. So we take the filter out. He looks at it, and Nick looks around to all of his fellows that he was bragging to about this new company that he started. He goes, but Fred, the filter is not on there. So I was trying to be witty at the time. I said, well, Nick, didn't I tell you it's a biodegradable filter? So anyways, we said, well, that was a fluke. Let's open another package. So another package opens, the filter goes in, particles get injected, particles go past the filter, and no capture. So we take it out. The next filter is without a filter, basically, just a loop. So we did that a few times, and we realized that our filters actually don't stay on our frame intravascularly. So with that successful experiment, we actually proceeded to build a fledgling filter company, which became the first filter in the U.S. market. That was EPI.
So EPI was sold in 2001. You had had negotiations with Guidant around the Endotex license technology, but the sale of EPI to Boston came, it seems, relatively quickly, particularly given, again, that Endotex was still going at the time. Were you part of the negotiations to Boston? Why did you sell so quickly? How did that whole deal with Boston Scientific come about?
I was part of the negotiations. I was definitely learning from Hank and just staying in his shadows in the process. But I learned a lot. Hank was a great chairman who let me kind of act like I'm actually doing it, but really had his steady hand in the background to help with that discussion. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from that.
Was there any temptation to hold EPI longer? I mean, obviously it was a good deal. It was a rich deal for the EPI investors, but does it not seem as if that was, you turned that company around pretty quickly?
I think Hank and I kept talking about it, and I think Hank kept sending me the signals without telling me that's what we should do. It's always better to take a fast nickel than a slow dollar. So when the deal actually came to the table, I don't think we had any issues about any consternations about are we selling too early, basically.
Mm-hmm. So EPI was sold in 2001, and you stayed at Boston for 18 months. What did you do there, and was that part of the deal, or were you not certain about doing another startup? Why did you stay at Boston for 18 months?
So the deal had a big tail associated with it, basically, a big earnout. what was important to me as we had started the company was that the technology actually makes it into the commercial space, that patients would actually benefit from it. And so I think I've tried to do that in everything that I've been involved with. The technologies, if you go back to Confluent, which was actually the first company mm-hmm. that we spun off of Incept, and that's actually how we got diverted to this EPI discussion. But Amar Sahani and I actually took a step back, started Incept, and the first company actually became Confluent, mm-hmm. based on his hydrogel technology. And Confluent went through a lot of ups and downs in the process. But we we did one more thing in starting Incept and Confluent, which I had learned from Endotex, and I and both of us had learned from Focal when we were at Focal, was that you take a technology, a platform technology, and put it in a company, it can only get used for one application. I mean, every company can really just focus on one application. You can't really go start five companies in one. That's just not going to happen. But if you put it into the company, every constituent that gets sitting around the table, basically, when you come back and say, hey, should we go do this outside with this other piece of the technology, they feel like you've actually put your hand in their pocket, basically, that you're trying to take the technology away. So just like money, I think companies shouldn't have a lot of technology in them. They should have enough technology that they can focus on and they can develop. So what we did was we actually went ahead and did a more of an application-specific license of Amar's technology to Confluent, mm-hmm. and kept the platform hydrogel technology, which is now used a little bit head-to-toe across the body, basically. But the first product that came out of Confluent was a product called Duracell. Mm-hmm. The point that I was trying to make is that we basically stuck to that for about 7 years until the product actually became commercial. At EPI, even though there was a transaction that took place, the team wanted to see the product actually go to the market, and that was actually important to us. And not leaving it in the hands of a big company, and this is no kind of indicting Boston Scientific, basically, but these technologies, if they're not in the top 10 list of the large companies, they flounder and they don't go anywhere. So we wanted to be there to actually commercialize the technology. We've done the same thing at Access Closure, which has been fun. So there's a little bit of a theme to the story of, and you had wanted me to talk a little bit about Incept. Mm-hmm. There's a little theme to this process of making sure that you're not just creating vehicles for transactions between private companies and large companies, but you actually create commercial technologies that make it out to the market, that touch patients in the process. And at some point in time during the course of that, you end up hopefully having a transaction or a public offering or something like that.
So I want to talk about Access, because that technology came out of technology that was developed at Confluent. Confluent was eventually sold to Covidien for about $250 million,
yes,
just a couple of years ago. That was another successful exit. How are you raising money for all these companies? And there's probably a half a dozen companies that came out of Incept in one form or another. What's your strategy for raising money? on the companies that have come out of INCEPT?
So INCEPT doesn't have any kind of physical existence anywhere. It's it's more of a virtual setup of a group of people who want to work together. There's no office, fax machine, phone number for INCEPT, so to speak. It's a vehicle that we haven't raised venture money for. And the reason we haven't raised venture money for it is that we think that you bring venture money into an incubator, you end up doing only certain things that the VCs would want you to basically focus on. And those end up being big opportunities, and those end up being great opportunities. But within an environment that you don't have any VC money in the incubator, you get to be a little bit more eclectic about the size of opportunities that you have. You could do singles and doubles, and they all don't have to be home runs. Mm-hmm. So there's no money in INCEPT. But INCEPT does fund its own companies to begin with, through to the tune of about between $250,000 to $500,000.
Is that coming from you and Amar, or is that coming from...
Yeah, that comes from proceeds of previous acquisitions, basically.
Mm-hmm. And then how have each of the companies been, for instance, where did Confluent get its first money? Where did EPI get its first money? Where did...
So Confluent got its first money from VCs, as well as EPI. But it was really more initially in an incubation phase. Mm-hmm. So it was a group of friends and physicians who came to our aid. In the case of EPI, it was Rob actually stepped up to the plate to fund an entrepreneur who had a tremendous failure right before that, which was pretty visionary of him. A vision that I didn't even believe in myself. So.
And where did Access was started in 2002. How did Access get off the ground? Where did you go for the funding of that? And by that point, had you, notwithstanding your own, the cloud of Endotex, by the time you started Access in 2002, had you pretty much banished thoughts of concerns about the Endotex? Has that experience passed you by that point?
No.
Does it still linger over you today?
Every day. Every day. It was a painful experience. I just saw my wife, Flora, coming in, and my daughter. She saw me when I came home and had my head between my legs, and it was pretty painful. Mm-hmm. And it was good that it was so painful, because it actually did some reorientation in me as a person.
So talk about Access. You started in 2002. Who funded it early on? And Access closure brings you into technology that Hank knew well from his Perclose days. Was Hank part of the Access closure team?
Exactly. So Hank and Rob almost, for me, became seatbelts. So I can't really drive the car anymore without the seatbelt. Yeah, so Hank had the background in closure. We had baked the technology that we had in Confluent, which was Amar's invention, and he had developed it for percutaneous site access site closure. But Confluent started going in a direction of becoming a surgery company.
Right.
And we decided to... our choice in front of us was to either basically stop the project, put it on the shelf, having learned again from the experiences of Endotex and being defocused and doing too many things at the same time, or spin it off as a new business. And so we decided to spin it off as a new business. It happened at about the same time that I was pretty much done being in a corporate setting, basically, for about a year and a half. I enjoyed it very much, but I was...
You enjoyed your time at Boston Scientific?
I did. I got to actually...
You didn't get frustrated at Boston Scientific?
I got frustrated all the time. It was a whole continuum of frustration. But you know what? But I actually got to... So having grown up at Guidance, or ACS, I should say, and I really try to carry that banner still, and proudly speak about it, basically. we were somehow institutionally led to believe that Boston, the Boston Scientific guys, are folks to be very leery of and what have you. And so we actually, when the negotiations were going on for EPI to get acquired, the two parties were Guidant and Boston Scientific. And I was probably the only person on the board who was not thinking objectively enough. I was even at a point in time willing to take a lesser deal from Guidant than because it was Guidant. I mean, yeah. I was willing to actually give a big price for the label and what I believed was the belief set at Guidant was. But going to Boston Scientific, I realized that there's a tremendous group of people that actually work there, especially in senior management. Jim Tobin became a guy who I learned a hell of a lot from. He doesn't speak much, but you can actually really learn from him. He's a true master of operations. And Paula Violet. I actually reported to Paula Violet and enjoyed every minute of it, basically. So it was a great team of folks.
So Access Closure is actually doing very well right now. And again, it's one of the technologies that you've seen all the way through to commercialization. Talk about how Access Closure is doing right now and what you think is the key to that company's success.
So Access is doing really well. The story is interesting. When we were spinning it off of Confluent to actually get it started, again, the only believers were Hank and Rob initially, and a group of clinicians who were close to the sequence of companies that I've been involved with. But most of the other folks who actually knew me would sit down with me and say, Fred, Closure? Are you crazy? who works on Closure?
Well, that's like another malware protection plan.
Yeah, exactly. It makes no sense whatsoever. How about the next bioerodible stent? How about the next kind of big thing in the process? And I really, really like this notion of the fact that the technology really will end up touching more patients than any other technology, basically, in terms of numbers and also in terms of the fact that I had seen Closure, I had seen PerClose, it looked complicated to me. It looked painful and complicated, even though it was a pioneering technology, basically. St. Jude, Angio-Seal, it looked like it hurt quite a bit. And to be able to actually come up with something that doesn't hurt, doesn't have the morbidities associated with it, it doesn't always have to be a play on mortality. Mm-hmm. It could be it could be something where you actually improve the morbidity, basically.
So it may be a question more for Hank than for you, but what did you learn? What did the PerClose experience, because that was one of the first big deals in femoral closure. What did the PerClose experience teach you about that you learned at Access Closure, that you took to Access Closure?
That you stick with it, that it's going to be rough process, everybody will throw a lot of dirt on you in the process, that it has to work all the time, that failure is not an option, but you're going to fail a lot. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of live and balance this whole complicated environment, basically.
We're running right up against time here, and I want to leave time for questions to the audience. There have been a couple of other companies that have come out of Incept, and I don't know if you want to talk to any one of them, Square One, Hotspur. An interesting one is Sadra Medical, because notwithstanding how much Endotex, you know, hangs over your head, the other companies that Confluent, EPI, Access Closure all have done extremely well. I mean, Access hasn't exited yet. Sadra goes back to one of those companies that has had its ups and downs, seems to be doing a lot better now. But talk about Sadra and what went right and what went wrong there, or what went wrong and then what went right.
So I would say Sadra is a...
Where did the idea for that come from?
The idea came from squarely from Amr Salahia, who, again, I've referred to in reference to EPI, and Don Bain, mm-hmm. And Paul Spence, who's a cardiac surgeon. Mm-hmm. I think it's a brilliant idea, but it is a difficult, nightmarish technological undertaking. Mm-hmm. So the first technology that was developed had so many moving parts, I'm embarrassed to actually kind of name the number.
Yeah.
That's how complicated it was. And it's a technology that needs to be built with almost aircraft quality standards, because you can't really fail in somebody's valve.
Yeah.
And so it's a very, very difficult technological undertaking. And so we've had our lumps in the road, so to speak, ups and downs in the process. But it's really coming to a stage where I think, being very, very biased, of course, so take it with a grain of salt as an entrepreneur who's too passionate. But I think it's going to be the next next generation of percutaneous valves, and it's going to take this market by a storm.
Another example of where sticking with something is pays off in the end. Even though you would have thought the Endotek's example was might have been to tell you to get out when you know it's time, when it's over. But Solder's a good example of a company that probably should have died, you know, two or three years ago.
Yeah, I actually have never been with a company that I would not look back and say it should have died, like, for one reason or another, basically. They all have the kind of those borderline moments of dying, and you have to just kind of jump in there. It's like jumping on a grenade, basically.
So what's your, and you're spending so much of your time, or all of your time, most of your time with Access, what's your relationship to some of these other newer companies that have been coming out, like Hotspur or Square One?
Yeah, I'm running, so I'm a workaholic, I work more than what I really supposed to do, basically, for one person, and that's what I was saying, that my nose has been very close to the grindstone over the last decade or so. And so I have a full-time job, and then I have a bunch of part-time jobs, basically. The full-time job is Access Closure, and then part-time jobs are Square One, which is an osteo stent company, Hotspur, which is a dialysis graft treatment company, Sodra Medical, which is a percutaneous valve company, and I'm quite excited about it. I enjoy it immensely, and I think most of it has a lot to do with the fact, kind of going back to the comment that I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, basically, is that, and I think really fueled by the experience at Endotex, that I realized that if you're the smartest guy in the place would be in serious trouble, basically. So the thing that really gets me out of bed every morning is actually going to work and working with my team at Access Closure, with Jim Fortune, with Brian, with some of the guys who I learned from every day. And I think that theme is recurring in any of the companies that I'm involved with.
Well, I will say this just in kind of wrapping up. I know Endotex was a painful experience for you, but I dare say that anybody in this room would trade your track record, their track record for your track record any day. Fred, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have 5 minutes for questions or so we take them. Just say them loudly, and then I'll repeat them. Any questions from the audience? Yeah, when are you going to retire? Do you ever think of that?
You know, I talked to Flora, my wife, about that, by the way, who's been really the rock who's allowed the workaholic to continue doing what he's doing like a maniac. And I said, so I'm thinking I should be retiring because I'm working way too much and this whole body can only take so much pain and suffering, so to speak. And she really looked at me. She goes, please. Please don't. there's just so much of you we can take in one place. So I've got my marching orders from the chairman of the board at home.
Do you? Let me ask one question. A lot of the companies you've been involved with have started have been cardiovascular companies, but you've got a couple that are not dialysis
yes.
company. And Confluent was a very successful company in surgical products. Is it just coincidence that so many of them are cardiovascular? Do you look for opportunities outside? And I guess the question is, obviously, it's you and Amar and other folks, Mark Woolley coming in and sharing ideas, Ulrich coming in and sharing ideas. How do you know when you're just chatting about something that sounds interesting and when you actually want to start a company around something?
Yeah. So with respect to cardiovascular first, my background's been cardiovascular. It's quite a rich area, basically. You can do a lot, and there's a lot of, or there has been over at least several years or so, a lot of holes to fill, a lot of kind of gaps to bridge in the process. So that's been really the theme of what I've done on my end. My partner on the East Coast, Amar Sahani, who definitely is the sharp knife in the drawer between the two of us, he has the capacity to be a little bit more eclectic in terms of his viewpoints on technology. So he's been involved in surgical treatment of abdomen and brain, and now he's working on an ophthalmic deal and a deal in prostate, so, and so on and so forth. So he's basically more focused on the platform technology that he has, applying it to different applications. I've been more focused on the space and coming up with different technologies.
Mm-hmm. But Millennium is a pharmaceutical company, and even Focal, which we didn't really spend a lot of time talking about, started as a drug delivery company. Are you ever tempted to go back into something more on the drug device convergence side? A lot of stuff seems to be doing is very mechanically oriented.
Yeah, so I think that has to do with the people that have come together. So the one thing about Incept and the fact that it's somewhat amorphous and not institutionalized, because of that, the technology's really grown not by a bunch of people sitting there and saying, okay, what should we focus on? What is the right thing to be focusing on for the next 10 years or so? It's more about a group of people kind of organically coming up with an idea and saying, what if we do this and that and kind of solve that problem? And so the technologies really kind of grow out of there, and the team as a result of it kind of grows out of the Incept opportunities themselves, as opposed to things coming in from the outside.
Is it harder today to start companies than you think than when you did in the mid-90s? Mid-90s were a time when the med tech industry was just coming into its own. It's got some peaks and valleys. But do you think it's, as you look forward to what you're going to do after Hotspur and after Square One, is it getting harder for you to start companies or for one in general?
Even if I didn't believe in it 3-4 months ago, I'd say, yeah. I mean, I think everybody in this room believes that it's going to be harder to start companies. It's going to get very difficult, and Paul and I were talking about this. I think it's, for me, the last few weeks, I'd say maybe 2-3 months or so, have been some pretty difficult times with respect to not access closure, but companies that have great technologies, definitely have a place out there in cath labs and on shelves.
Yeah. We'll just finish your thought, and then we'll get to this. Get to that question.
No, but go ahead, let him.
Yeah, I think just so finally, it's more of a comment than a question. I don't know how many people don't know yet, but NIH received $10 billion in economic recovery funds, stimulus package funds, and they're starting to distribute that to corporate entities, regardless of size, some of them regardless of size. The other thing, National Science Foundation receives $3 billion, and they're really active in regenerative and stuff related to regenerative medicine, stem cells, diagnostics. They're moving into that area. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that. I've helped a lot of companies go after government to fund it, and it's a real opportunity now, given the lack of venture capital availability.
But Obama may oust you as the CEO if you don't do it right.
We have one more question back here.
Fred, when you started Endotex, the carotid artery is pretty much the property of the vascular surgeon. And so bringing in a new technology that changed the boundary of medicine from one specialty to another, describe a little more about how that made it difficult for your business to get a foothold.
Yeah, so I think what really should have taken 4 or 5 years, it took about, I think, 11 years, right, John, to get commercial. It's pretty profound.
And it still hasn't penetrated.
And it still hasn't penetrated. It's still, like, just cracked the market.
Okay.
Well, that is actually an interesting thing. I mean, we are running right against time, but there are different cycles. Small companies can realize an opportunity, realize a benefit from a technology that large companies, you know, you really need large companies to develop the market or to live with it long enough to. And Carotid is actually a good example of one where lots of great startups, lots of great small companies. But if you didn't have big companies there backing that technology in that clinical space, I don't think any small company could have survived that for that long a period of time.
I agree.
Well, great. Fred, thank you very much. The alcohol is flowing in the outside. Thank you all.